Welcome to NTD Evening News. Our top story tonight, Russian warships rolling into Cuba. As the Biden administration rolls out new sanctions to stop China from helping Russia's war machine, how they'll work and why the U.S. is signing a new security agreement with Ukraine. Hamas is demanding changes to a possible ceasefire deal. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Qatar working on the deal, saying the demands are not acceptable. House Republicans vote to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress. What does this mean for the probe into President Biden's handling of classified documents? Attorney General Merrick Garland joined federal agency leaders today to mark a 10-year milestone of efforts to combat elder abuse. Garland spoke at a special meeting to celebrate agency accomplishments. And Southern Baptists vote on churches headed by women pastors. What does this mean for one of the country's largest religious organizations?
This is NTD Evening News, live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City. Here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. The U.S. expanding sanctions on Russia to stop countries like China from sustaining Russia's war machine. This comes as President Biden heads to Italy for the G7 summit, where he'll ramp up pressure on China's unfair trade practices. NTD's Iris Tao has more from Bari, Italy.
President Biden has now landed here in Italy, where he will talk with G7 leaders about ramping up pressure on China and Russia. And right before the summit here tomorrow, the U.S. Treasury Department announced a slew of new sanctions aimed at stopping countries like China from supplying Russia with equipment and materials used in the war against Ukraine. Here's the White House detailing those sanctions. Watch.
We have also been clear with the PRC that we reserve the right to take action against particular companies and entities that we believe are engaged in supporting Russia's war machine through the provision of inputs, whether it's industrial materials or microelectronics or UAV parts or whatever it may be. And we have put our money where our mouth is.
And Beijing has been ramping up its support for Moscow, including by selling it dual-use computer chips made using U.S. technology. Wednesday's actions widened existing sanctions to target those goods. In addition to China's support for Russia, G7 leaders here will also address China's unfair trade practices.
We will confront China's non-market policies that are leading to harmful global spillovers.
And on Ukraine, Biden is set to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Thursday and sign a new security agreement to pledge America's long-term support to the country.
Making clear our support will last long into the future and pledging continued cooperation, particularly in the defense and security space.
Another focus here among G7 leaders is to discuss sending Ukraine a massive loan using profits generated by frozen Russian assets. President Biden will also use this opportunity to amplify his view that America needs to stand with allies and bolster democracy, a theme key to his 2024 campaign. Reporting in Bari, Italy, Iris Tao, NTD News.
And a quick update from the White House on the Hunter Biden gun case. When pressed by reporters, the White House did not rule out commuting the sentence for the president's son. The spokesperson repeated the president's previous statement that he won't pardon his son. The judge hasn't set a sentencing date, but it is expected to be sometime in October. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Qatar today. He's trying to push forward a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, but major hurdles remain. Here's that story.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Hamas wants changes to a possible ceasefire deal that are not acceptable.
Look, as I said, based on what we saw last night, the response from Hamas, numerous changes proposed to the deal that was on the table and that the entire world has gotten behind, but some of those are workable changes. Some, as I said, are not.
He didn't lay out exactly what changes Hamas is seeking, but said the mediators will keep trying to close the deal. Blinken put the blame on Hamas for changing its demands. He also expressed frustrations at how long it took the U.S.-designated terrorist group to respond to President Biden's peace proposal, 12 days. This comes as Hezbollah fired a massive barrage of rockets into northern Israel on Wednesday, one of the biggest from the group since the war began. Israel's military says it detected about 215 projectiles, some of which were intercepted, the strikes causing several fires. The Iran-backed terrorist group is avenging the killing of a top commander. The Pentagon on Wednesday urging both sides to de-escalate.
We don't want to see a wider regional conflict, and that's why we do want to see a de-escalation of tensions in the region.
Meanwhile, the director of the World Health Organization gave a dire warning about the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions.
Blinken also said the U.S. will insist that Israel and other countries follow international humanitarian law and the laws of armed conflict.
And we have a number of our own processes within the U.S. administration, including within my own department, to assess whether Israel or any other combatant in any other conflict is adhering to those.
After leaving Doha on Wednesday, the top U.S. diplomat flew to Italy to join President Biden for the G7 summit. Israeli forces recently managed to rescue four hostages who were being held by Hamas. The mother of one of them recounted the first conversation she had with her son after his release.
For a few minutes, I probably didn't know how to react, but then I started laughing, and I've been laughing all the time ever since. I'm absolutely happy.
At least 120 Israeli hostages still remain in Gaza.
House Republicans have voted to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress. This after he refused to turn over recording related to an investigation into President Biden's handling of classified documents. The audio tape contains Biden's interview with then special counsel Robert Hur, who conducted the investigation but decided not to pursue charges. The 216 to 207 vote is the result of House GOP's months-long efforts to unveil the classified materials. Ohio Congressman Dave Joyce is the only Republican who voted against it. House Speaker Mike Johnson will now certify the report to the U.S. Attorney for D.C. The certification will then require the U.S. Attorney to bring the case before the grand jury. The DOJ will also make its own decisions for prosecuting. Unity between Republicans and Democrats on full display today at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing. While both parties agree on the national security threats in the Western Hemisphere, their policy prescriptions differ. Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has the details.
Lawmakers deposed officials from the State Department and USAID as part of Wednesday's hearing. Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul, highlighted that it's China, Russia, and Iran, the actors that are expanding their malign activities in the Americas.
As we speak, four Russian warships, including a nuclear-powered submarine and a frigate carrying hypersonic missiles, are set to arrive in Cuba. China is bankrolling the dictatorship in Nicaragua, and Iran is looking to station Quds forces in Venezuela.
During a recess for votes, I spoke with a Democratic ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Gregory Meeks, and he agreed with his Republican counterparts that it's China, Russia, and Iran, the greatest sources of national security risks in the Western Hemisphere, but disagreed with Republicans' viewpoint that this should be examined through the lens of great power competition. Let's listen.
To say that it's the great power competition, meaning that we're only going to look to do to stop or to block China, so the interest is not our friends and our allies in the continent, it's only about China. So yes, we want to compete with China, but the reason what we want to do is to make sure that we're doing the right thing in our hemisphere and for the countries in our hemisphere.
While some Republicans suggested military support to close down the Darien Gap in between Colombia and Panama to stem the flow of migrants north, others, like Democratic Congressman Jonathan Jackson, suggested having closer ties with the governments of Cuba and Venezuela.
It is no longer acceptable that we have the poorest nation in the world off of our shores. When President Trump was leaving out and he put terrorism status on Cuba, that in turn made their economy falter. So our migration, if you will, crisis in six urban cities has come from foreign policy as it goes into Venezuela. We need to reverse some of these. We need to normalize relationships, strengthen our own hemisphere.
Throughout the hearing, House Democrats pushed for increased funding for State Department operations. This Wednesday, though, House Appropriations Committee approved the State Department operations budget for fiscal year 2025 with a 6% decrease compared to fiscal year 2024. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
Attorney General Merrick Garland and the Justice Department celebrated Elder Justice today. Garland joined 17 agencies at a meeting of the Elder Justice Coordinating Council, or EJCC, to recognize a decade of federal progress in combating elder abuse.
Every year, millions of older adults experience some form of elder abuse, neglect, financial exploitation, or fraud. We know that the vast majority of elder abuse cases go unreported.
Garland said the DOJ has aggressively targeted perpetrators of elder fraud and abuse while providing victims with the support they need, resulting in hundreds of millions of dollars returned to elderly victims. The EJCC was established by the 2010 Elder Justice Act to coordinate federal activities related to elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation. Leaders from the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as four pioneers of the elder justice movement, also gave remarks at the EJCC meeting. The nation's largest Protestant denomination narrowly voted down a proposal today. They will not enshrine a rule to ban churches with women pastors. Opponents argue the Southern Baptist Convention already has a way to oust such churches without the need for a formal ban. During the second day of their two-day gathering in Indianapolis, 61% of the delegates voted in favor of the ban. However, it didn't receive a required two-thirds supermajority vote to become official. Southern Baptist doctrine holds that the office of pastor is limited to men. Just before today's vote, one delegate noted that the convention had voted earlier to cut ties with a historic member church in Virginia. And last year, the group ousted the California Saddleback megachurch. Both churches had women pastors. Coming up, a potential trade war is brewing between the European Union and China. An analyst joins us to discuss the latest actions and their potential impacts. Flavored vape pens are being sold walking distance from FDA headquarters. Lawmakers grill officials over the teen vaping crisis. More when we come back here on NTD News. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. The European Union said today that it would impose tariffs of up to 38% on Chinese electric vehicles coming into the bloc. The decision follows Washington's tariff hikes on Chinese EVs set at 100%.
The Commission has reached out to the Chinese authorities to discuss these findings and explore possible ways for resolving the issues identified. The Commission has also pre-disclosed today the level of provisional countervailing duties it would impose on imports of battery electric vehicles from China.
The Vice President of the EU Commission said China's unfair trade practices have injured European automakers. The bloc is now trying to discuss solutions with Chinese authorities. Last year, the EU bloc imported over $11 billion worth of Chinese electric cars. EU automakers can't compete with China's significantly lower prices. EU leaders raised concerns about Beijing's unfair subsidies last week. The Chinese Commerce Minister dismissed their accusations. Last October, the EU Commission launched an anti-subsidy investigation into China's EV supply chain. Earlier, we spoke with Chris Holton, senior analyst at the Center for Security Policy, about the trade disputes between the EU and China. Chris Holton, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, headlines are warning that we could be seeing another trade war. This is after the EU announced increased tariffs on Chinese EV imports starting in July. This is citing unfair state subsidies from China. Now, Beijing has vowed to retaliate by hitting the agriculture industry, with pork and dairy being the first to be hit. Now, that's according to Chinese state-run Global Times. Given that, though, what would be the impact on the European agriculture industry?
Well, it could possibly have a major impact on the European agriculture industry, and it has to be looked at in the context of China's overall trade policies, which basically they don't think any of the rules apply to them. So the Chinese will do whatever they have to do that they see in their own best interests, even if they're violations of trade agreements and international law. So this could be a great impact on European farmers, unfortunately. And I have no doubt that the European measures about Chinese electric vehicles is very warranted. This comes as no surprise. We've seen this as a pattern from the Chinese communists for decades now.
Now, looking at some numbers, Politico notes that China consumes more pork than the rest of Asia and Africa combined. Part of this is due to byproducts like snouts, ears, and tails, which Westerners don't consume, but China does. Now, that being said, only a tenth of Europe's pork goes beyond its borders, and of that amount, less than half winds up in China. How big of a blow would this then be to the European agriculture industry?
Well, I think they would survive without that trade. China gets a lot of pork from elsewhere. So I think that the Europeans should stick to their guns, so to speak, when it comes to trade, because the Chinese need the European market a lot more than the Europeans need the Chinese market in terms of pork, anyway.
And how would all of this impact the U.S., or does it impact us?
Well, it could possibly, ironically, benefit U.S. pork industry. However, you know, China is not innocent when it comes to the U.S. agriculture industry as well. What they're doing in the United States is buying up agriculture land at an alarming rate, which is a concern. And that's something that the Europeans probably ought to be on the lookout for, Chinese efforts to buy up agriculture land and agriculture companies in the European area as well, because they'll do that in an effort to control the food supply and food security.
Now, zooming out a bit, when it comes to these EV tariffs, these are aimed at protecting industries from cheap Chinese imports. This is because Europe is a top destination for Chinese EVs. Now, the Rhodium Group think tank notes that Chinese EV imports to the EU topped $11 billion last year. Now, the EU is also set to investigate Chinese solar and wind products, but it also needs those products to hit its green energy commitments by 2035. How do you see the EU balancing this?
Well, there's going to have to be a real balancing, as you say, on these green energy targets. Most of them are completely unrealistic. For one thing, the power grid can't sustain the number of electric vehicles that these targets are calling for. There's a big disconnect between reality and these targets. So from that standpoint, I would essentially reject the idea that that they need to reach these targets. It's completely unrealistic to try to do so. And it's going to be tremendously damaging to the European economy should these targets stay in place through 2035.
Quite concerning indeed. Chris Holden, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And now an exciting announcement. NTD's original documentary, Hollywood Takeover, China's Control in the Film Industry, is coming to the big screen in New York City this Saturday. It will screen at the Manhattan Film Festival on June 15th at 1 p.m. Here's a preview. Is it really just about money? Are there other parts at stake?
Chinese influence was playing into what we see in U.S. films.
China said, you can't have that in there. And Hollywood listened. This is insane.
And we all know that their goal is global domination.
People have been brainwashed without knowing it.
That's this Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Manhattan Film Festival. Don't miss it. Use the link down below to get your tickets. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee heard from a panel of experts who were split on how Washington's industrial policies are impacting businesses and consumers. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley brings us more.
The bipartisan, bicameral Joint Economic Committee heard from a panel of experts that were split over Washington's policies and if they contributed to the economic growth in the U.S. In particular, the subsidies that Washington provided to businesses, did they contribute to the economic growth? For example, the CHIPS and Science Act provides $39 billion in subsidies to semiconductor plant and construction and equipment. We've also seen the Inflation Reduction Act impact these businesses. One of the main issues here is if it will help outcompete China, which uses subsidies to compete and flood the market with cheap products. One panelist said that it helped his company grow and people see it as more jobs for businesses. But another panelist said that Americans benefit more from tax cuts, a more hands-off government approach, and that using government subsidies is in fact a form of redistributing wealth from people and businesses to other businesses and can in fact make people poorer. Back to you.
Flavored vape pens are being sold walking distance from FDA headquarters. Lawmakers grill officials over the teen vaping crisis. Here's the story.
One of my friends was so addicted, she would say things like, I'll just die at 20, whatever.
2.1 million teens vaped in 2023, a third of whom were just in middle school. At a Senate hearing Wednesday, lawmakers asked the FDA why it's failing to tackle the problem.
This is a shelf full of potentially dangerous substances in a store in the shadow of the FDA building. I'm just trying to figure out if any of this is illegal or how in the hell it's legal.
Senator Tom Tillis points to flavors such as strawberry, dragon fruit, watermelon, even watermelon bubble gum. The FDA's director of tobacco products, Brian King, never directly answered.
We do have a pre-market paradigm for reviewing applications, and the sheer volume of that, the volume of those applications and the volume of the market requires us to prioritize our enforcement efforts.
The president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Yolanda Richardson, answered in his place.
FDA failed to assert its regulatory authority over e-cigarettes until a substantial e-cigarette market had already formed and e-cigarettes had already become the most popular tobacco product among youth. FDA then further delayed.
E-cigarette popularity exploded in the mid-2000s when they entered the market. The U.S. market was valued at $28 billion in 2023 and is expected to grow at a compound annual rate of 30.6% from 2023 to 2030. Only 23 e-cigarette brands are authorized for sale in the U.S., but over 6,000 brands are on the market.
Over a quarter of youth e-cigarette users use the products every day. One of the primary reasons, as you have heard, children are attracted to e-cigarettes is the sweet fruit, candy, and mint flavors they come in.
Dr. Susan Wally helps people get off nicotine products. She says it's very difficult to get children to quit because of the high nicotine volume in vapes.
The adolescent brain is more susceptible to nicotine addiction, so symptoms of dependence can appear in days to weeks of first experimentation.
She says for most teens, usage is consistent, frequent, and dependent, such as the case with high schooler Josie Shapiro.
The first flavor I tried was blueberry ice. But I tried pretty much every flavor my friends had. I thought I was just enjoying the flavors, but soon my 14-year-old brain craved the nicotine more and more.
Shapiro is still addicted. She says vaping is affecting her mood, her ability to breathe, her skin, and her social life.
I've tried to quit vaping over and over again, but it's really, really hard. Everything in my life is a trigger. Hanging out with friends, driving my car, going to the bathroom, going into the convenience store. All of it makes me want to vape.
The FDA and Department of Justice have pledged further cooperation in battling teen vaping. They're forming a task force with several other agencies, including the Postal Service.
Coming up, China and Russia are expected to be at the top of the agenda during the G7 summit. An analyst joins us to discuss the latest in international affairs. A bill to end some move-in fees for renters, supporters and protesters alike rallied outside New York City City Hall today ahead of a public hearing. We'll give you both sides of the debate. That's coming up. Joining us now to discuss the G7 summit, as well as the latest sanctions on Russia, is Anders Kor, publisher of the Journal of Political Risk and principal of Kor Analytics. Anders, thank you so much for joining us. Great to see you again. Now, President Biden is headed to the G7 summit in Italy as Russia and China loom large as topics. What is your analysis of this year's summit?
The G7 summit coming up will be about a whole range of things, from development, economy, security. On the security issue, they'll be looking at Gaza, of course, and Russia, China. So these are the major issues that we'll be seeing coming out of the G7.
Now, ahead of the G7 summit, the U.S. has widened sanctions against Russia. Over 300 sanctions are aimed at deterring China and other countries from doing business with Moscow as the war in Ukraine continues. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is saying that Russia's military is, quote, desperate for access to the outside world. What are your thoughts on this? What further action can we expect on Russia?
The big shift we're seeing is in terms of the Russia sanctions, are a shift from sanctions that are directed specifically at Russia to sanctions on secondary countries like China that are facilitating Russia through financing, the bank financing, or military materiel, or more often, semiconductors, other export-controlled items that have a U.S. brand on them and are being transshipped, essentially, or produced in China and then sent over to Russia.
And so how successful of a deterrent do you see this being?
It's important. It's the next step in the process. I mean, there's many steps ahead, I think, in terms of how Washington can increase economic sanctions, tariffs, pressure on Russia to change its course in Ukraine. But this is an important step. I don't think it will be the end of it. China has a huge incentive to ensure that Russia wins in Ukraine so that China can hopefully, on its perspective, invade and succeed in Taiwan. Now, that would require it would help if Russia wins in Ukraine.
Speaking of China, another big topic is China's overcapacity. This comes as the EU just threatened to hike tariffs on Chinese EVs. How do you see G7 members addressing Chinese overcapacity in markets?
China wants to have an overcapacity to fuel its exports, essentially. So instead of directing its economy to its own consumers who are paid less than they should, probably, what it's doing is it's using the profits from all of these exports and the low wages it pays its workers to fund its military expansion. So this is the basic dynamic. As Europe and the United States are figuring this out, we're realizing that we need to increase our own industrial capacity. We can't just rely on imports from China. And to do that, we're putting in place tariffs. And so the hope is that that the European Union will increase its tariffs in the same way that the United States has increased tariffs on China so that we can get essentially friendshoring, which is the instead of buying everything from China, which ultimately wants to do away with the U.S.-led international system, we'll be buying more from friends who will help us defend that system.
And what can we or might we expect to see from Beijing in response to these tariffs?
Beijing, is trying its best to shift and adapt its economy to export. If we throw up our tariffs, it wants to shift its exports to places like Africa, Latin America, and of course, South America. Even before it does that, it's going to try to transship its products through countries like Mexico, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Pakistan, other countries that I would call sort of a second tier set of the axis of evil. These are countries that aren't really part of the axis of evil, but they're facilitating the axis by helping transship goods from China, Russia, and other places to us through their own manufacturing capabilities.
And all of this does come as Russian warships have arrived in Cuba for military exercises. This is just off of the coast of Florida. Are we seeing Cold War allies strengthening their ties? What does this mean for the U.S. and our allies?
We are seeing a second Cold War coming, a new Cold War. This warship visit is part of that. It's a form of brinkmanship, nuclear brinkmanship, really, because these are nuclear-capable ships. Russia is trying to send us a message that if we push them too hard, they might hit back.
Anders Kaur, publisher of the Journal of Political Risk and principal at Kaur Analytics, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nearly 3 weeks after General Hospital actor Johnny Wachter was shot and killed in downtown Los Angeles, his family is urging city leaders to take more action. NTD's Christina Corona has more on the story.
Wachter's family held a news conference Wednesday morning as part of the Justice for Johnny Wachter march. Friends, family, and community leaders are calling on city leaders, including Mayor Karen Bass, to fully support and provide resources to the Los Angeles Police Department in its homicide investigation.
We're here today to honor Johnny's memory and to call for justice in the wake of this senseless tragedy. His life was cruelly taken from us in an act of unnecessary violence. He was simply walking to his car and ending his bartending shift when he encountered three individuals attempting to steal his catalytic converter.
The 37-year-old was fatally shot last month after confronting the individuals. The suspects fled in a vehicle and Wachter died shortly after at a local hospital.
But this crime also sends a chilling message. We do not know who else these individuals could have harmed or who they may harm in the future if they're not brought to justice. Taking someone's life for a piece of metal.
Johnny's brother, Grant Wachter, flew to Los Angeles from South Carolina to speak.
Back home was world hurting, obviously. Thank you all for being here and helping us keep this out there so we can continue to press this issue. But the main thing is just senseless act of violence. It was something that none of us expected. He was 37 years old, maybe 38 August. Yeah, it hurts.
They are also pushing city leaders to issue a minimum $25,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest of the individuals responsible for Wachter's death. Following the news conference, family members and friends marched to Los Angeles City Hall to call for justice.
What do we want? We want safe streets. What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now!
Anyone with information on his case is urged to call the LAPD's Central Station. Christina Corona, NTD News.
A rally against mandatory broker fees in front of New York City's City Hall today ahead of a public hearing. Participants want to pass a bill that they say will make renting more affordable in the city. Brokers also assembled to protest the bill, saying it will only create more problems. NTD's Fiona Ji was on scene to speak with both sides.
You show up to this lease signing and you have to pay a broker fee ranging from 15 to 30% of your annual rent to a broker that your landlord hired. That ain't right and it's unfair.
The bill, known as the FAIR Act, would have whoever hires the broker pay the fee. instead of the current norm where tenants are the ones required to pay the broker fee, even if it were the landlord who hired the broker. Supporters of the bill say that currently, working class renters are often unable to afford move-in fees, which include the broker fee that can range up to thousands of extra dollars. However, protesters against the bill say that removing the broker fee will actually cause an increase in rent prices. They also say that brokers are an important part of the house hunting process.
It would impact us and the landlords because the rents would become higher because the landlords would have to pay some of the fees, and that would raise the rents, and it also takes away from us direct relationship with the clients.
Well, I can't move out of where I'm at and move into the city simply because, you know, who's going to pay that much money just on a broker? It's more than the actual rent or the security. The rents won't go higher. We're paying people to do absolutely nothing.
I've saved my clients so much money in the long run. We provide a lot to these clients. We're building relationships. We're cultivating just a little bit of everything to the clients.
Last year, I had to move into an apartment, and total move-in fee was like $12,000. It makes it to where, like, even if you were in a bad place, you wouldn't want to find a new one. You try to do whatever you can to stay there just to not deal with the fees of having to move in.
Last year in 2023, New York City Councilmember Chi Osei had already introduced this bill, but it never made it to a vote in the council. This year he has reintroduced it, and it remains to be seen what will happen with it. New York City is one of only two cities in America that requires tenants to pay the broker fee. But with housing pricing continuing to increase, this topic remains a subject of debate. Fiona G, NTD News.
Coming up in the NBA, the passing of one of the all-time greats. Dave Martin joins us to discuss Jerry West's impact. $500,000 goes to the last person standing in a competition of man versus nature. Daniel Monahan speaks with a contestant who survived in the wilderness in the hit show Alone. And the largest public library system in California says there's a boost in signups for its summer reading program. David Lamb flips through the pages when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, plenty going on today, but let's start in the NBA, where Hall of Famer Jerry West passed away this morning at the age of 86. What made him so great?
You know, a number of things, really. You know, he was elected the Basketball Hall of Fame three different times. Once as a player, once as a member of the 1960 U.S. Olympic squad that won gold, and then the third time as an NBA executive. So he had quite an impact, a long total career there. As a player, he was in the league 14 years, made the All-Star team all 14 seasons, was nicknamed Mr. Clutch for his late game heroics and playoff exploits. I mean, he was still the only player ever to win NBA Finals MVP while playing for the losing team. That was all the way back in 1969. And boy, he had some really clutch moments for sure. There was a time he hit a 60-foot half-court shot, beyond half-court shot, to tie a game in regulation, game three of the 1970 NBA Finals, sent the game to overtime. Amazing thing was, as soon as he hit it, he just walked back to the bench like he fully expected to do that while the crowd was going nuts. Even the NBA logo itself is rumored to be a silhouette of him. They've never denied that, they've never confirmed it either, but he is one of the all-time greats for sure.
Now, West is also credited with rebuilding the Lakers into champions two different times as general manager after his playing career was over. How long was he in charge of the Lakers?
Yeah, he was in the general manager spot for about 20 years. And that goes from like the early 80s, around 1980, when they had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, they drafted Magic Johnson. That takes you all the way up to their like second dynasty when they had Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, and Phil Jackson in charge. So he was really in charge of two dynasties there. And you could say the first one was like an inherited one, but he did draft Magic Johnson and then James Worthy later, and those two along with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar are in the Hall of Fame. Even more amazing, though, how quickly he rebuilt them into another dynasty. I mean, by 1991, Magic had retired and Kareem had retired. He then, within 5 years, he had signed Shaq, he drafted Kobe, and then a few years later, he added Phil Johnson to the mix. Now, even after that, even after he stepped aside from the Lakers, he then became a consultant for the Golden State Warriors. That team ended up winning 3 titles in 4 years when he was with them. So not only was he a talented player himself, he was a shrewd evaluator of talent in other players for sure. So he was quite an impressive guy.
Shifting gears to Olympic news, transgender swimmer Leah Thomas lost a legal battle that could have allowed Leah to compete in the Olympics as a female. What international body decides these things? What was their reasoning?
You know, there's like 2 international bodies you're working at there. First is World Aquatics. They make the rules for international swimming standards so that they're all unified all across the country, or all across the world, actually. They prohibit anyone who has undergone any part of male puberty from competing as a female. So that ruling was upheld by the Court of Arbitration for Sport against Leah Thomas, which is kind of the second international body, that's the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Their rulings are recognized by the Olympics. Now, they simply said Thomas had no standing to challenge the rules since Thomas technically wasn't a part of U.S. swimming. Now, Thomas, of course, is well known for winning an NCAA title, the first transgender to win an NCAA title 2 years ago in the female division. That was like just a year after Thomas competed as Will Thomas, who was ranked in the 500s in the same race. So anyway, this ruling, though, effectively ends Thomas's hopes of competing at least in this year's Summer Olympics.
Well, tonight we have game 3 of the NBA Finals between the Dallas Mavericks and the Boston Celtics. Dallas currently trails 2-0. What do they need to do to get a win?
Well, simply said, they need to get Kyrie Irving going. I mean, that's no secret. He struggled in those 2 games in Boston, missed all 8 of his 3-pointers, shot just 35% from the floor. I mean, he was booed every time he touched the ball. I'm sure that affected him. But game 3 tonight is going to be in Dallas, so I think there's a good chance he gets back on track at home. And we'll also have to see about Kristaps Porzingis and his injury. A lot has been made of his impact in the series thus far, at least from the offensive end. But on the defensive end, he's also a tremendous rim protector. Without him, Al Horford probably plays more minutes. He's still a great option despite age 38. Now, they could bring in a 3rd-string center. I think they're just going to play it small. I think they'll have probably Jason Tatum be guarding the post like they've had in a couple of other games. And they'll probably just give more minutes to their stars, which isn't a big deal because they've had a number of days off in this series and since last week. Now, Dallas is down 2-0, as you said. They absolutely have to win tonight. No team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit to win.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tiff.
Alone in the wilderness with nothing to keep you alive but your own wits. NTD's Daniel Monahan speaks with Jody Rose, who survived in Reindeer Lake, northern Saskatchewan, to try to win $500,000 in prize money as part of the History Channel's hit show, Alone.
Jody Rose says she learned her bushcraft skills from her homesteading parents. The self-reliant pair built everything from scratch, including a 2-room cabin after they got married.
If I need something, I can build it and make it. I carved an entire fishing pole by hand with just my pocket knife, or it was actually my multi-tool, but it has a working reel and everything.
Rose says she didn't eat animals during her time on Alone, except for the minnows in the lake in her water. She wasn't ready to sacrifice them until it was necessary.
But I mostly ate the cranberries, and I had blueberries. I had the reindeer moss. I started getting leg cramps like within like a week there. So I started eating the birch bark, the inside of the birch bark, to get magnesium and potassium. I ate mushrooms.
Rose says the most important thing for her was building a high quality shelter.
I don't like being cold, for one thing, but gets it down to negative 40s, negative 60s up there. And I live in that kind of weather year round. And I've been in hunting camp when it drops down to negative 20 degrees. And it's miserable and it's freezing.
Rose succeeded in making an amazing cabin. But on day 17, something happened.
I was inside of my cabin and I was cooking some food. And I heard my mom call out to me. She said, Jody, I need you. And it was weird because obviously my mom wasn't there.
She wrestled with leaving for a few days, but on day 22, she couldn't put it off any longer and had to tap out.
It turns out that my father was septic and my mom didn't know it. And she told me that my dad wasn't feeling well. And I said, you need to get him to the emergency room.
Rose says if she hadn't tapped out when she did, she very well could have lost both of her parents.
As for the pull of the great outdoors, the alone survivor says being in touch with nature brings people back to their true origin.
For me, it's both. It's nature and God. And we can find God in his creations. And trees and animals and nature is one of the best ways to find it. And if we can connect to that, then we find out who we really are and what we're capable of.
Daniel Monahan, NTD News.
The public library system in the nation's 13th largest city is seeing a spike in interest in its summer reading program. The San Jose Public Library spans 25 locations in Silicon Valley. NTD's David Lamb reports.
Shh, I'm at the King Library in San Jose, so I have to keep my voice low. But the big news is their summer readership interest is high.
Registration for San Jose Public Library's Summer Learning Program, located in Silicon Valley, and the number of book giveaways is increasing drastically, according to the library system.
These events are, they all have an educational component, and they're fun. So some of them could be like a petting zoo or magic bubbles, arts and crafts, an author event.
Nancy Macias with the library said more than 6,000 people of all ages registered to its program. Readers recorded over 200,000 reading minutes tracked in the first 12 days. But the plot thickens. The library's goal is to reach 4 million minutes read this summer and to pass last year's 10,000 signups with incentives and prizes for reaching reading goals. There's a 47% increase in signups compared to last year. The program lasts from June 1st to end of July. She said the summer programs would help prevent kids from academically sliding down.
It was created to help prevent the summer slide, which tends to happen when children are on summer break and not really in a school setting where they're reading and keeping up with academics.
Dee Han, mother of a 2- and 4-year-old, says she takes her kids to the library 2 to 3 times a week.
I think it really like makes them speak better. I come from a family where English wasn't like a primary language, so I feel like they're learning to express themselves a lot more through words, and that's what I couldn't do when I was growing up.
Macias says signups for adults went up nearly 80% than last year.
For me, I like to read philosophy books. So like one of my favorite books is like Art of War. And then for them, it's obviously like dinosaurs, and him, it's like princess books.
During the summer, it's enticing to go to the water parks or the beaches, but the library staffs hope that people could pick up a book as well and to just increase their lifelong learning and to enjoy knowledge. Reporting in San Jose, California, David Lamb, NTD News.
And that's all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.